Blended or step families have become a new normal. How does that affect their finances? Hi, I'm Rob West. Around 40% of families in the U.S. are blended with at least one child from a previous relationship. That presents challenges for estate planning. Valerie Hogan joins us today to talk about it. And then we'll take your calls at 800-525-7000. That's 800-525-7000. This is Faith and Finance Live, biblical wisdom for your financial journey. Well, it's always fun and educational, I might add, to have Valerie Hogan on the program. We learn a lot. She's an author, an attorney, a certified financial planner, and she's a part of Kingdom Advisors as well. Valerie, great to have you back with us.
Thanks for having me on today, Rob.
Absolutely. Valerie, you touch on a number of topics related to estate planning for blended families in your book, Wise Women Managing Money, and it all starts with communication, doesn't it?
Absolutely. I mean, open, transparent, truthful, and that may be difficult at times, but that's really important to be bringing the issues forward.
There's no doubt about that, and that involves some prayer as well, doesn't it, as we bring Christ into the process?
Absolutely. I mean, it's just a lot easier to work through things when we have that ultimate common goal of honoring Christ in our life. So we won't get it right every time, but if we can make peace and then, of course, redemption and restoration, he's in the business of that after all, as the goal, I think we'll really make some forward motion there.
Yeah, that's really helpful. Valerie, as we think about that communication, obviously spouses in blended families may have different goals. So how do they work through that? How would you counsel them?
Yeah, I mean, many times there's all kinds of, all manner of blended families, but we tend to see there's kind of the his, hers, and ours sometimes. Yeah. So compromise is going to be really important. I like to say seek understanding, or there's a saying, seek first to understand, then to be understood. I love a great question when you hear something that you're not necessarily in agreement with right away. Instead of kind of countering right away, I think a great response might be, tell me more about that, to really get an understanding of where your spouse is coming from, if they're saying something that is not really in alignment with what you think. And then when that gets really difficult, I think there can be a third party that can come in to maybe counsel through that, to just get another opinion in there and maybe a neutral opinion to help a couple through that.
Yeah. And the goal, of course, is to meet the needs of both families in the process, right?
Yeah, you really want to get to at least some common goals. Ultimately, it'd be great to be pulling in the same direction on everything. But there may be some goals that are just different. So at least you'd want to get to a process then where you can agree and make peace with some of those being separate goals, but not opposite, or, you know, pulling away from what the other is doing. So you may have hopefully some goals that you're pursuing together. And then if there is an independent goal, that both spouses are on board with that.
What do you see as some of the common sticking points with blended families?
Well, then there's this kind of his, hers, and ours. So I would say that many times there would be children maybe from a previous marriage versus a current one. And I think children on either side could tend to feel like, well, you know, the new family is more important, or maybe the new family feels like, why do we keep going back to the previous family? So I think one of the common sticking points, especially with children that are maybe older, is that they're wondering if they're still important. They're wondering if they're going to be kind of crowded out, or am I noticed? Are things fair? And really, am I important and valued?
Yes.
So that's one thing. I think older children can feel like maybe they would be left out or disinherited. And then families might be coming in with different levels of wealth, different assets, just different experiences. So you might have that conflict as well of how do we work this all out?
Yes, that's so helpful. Well, Valerie, we've just scratched the surface today, so we're going to have you back. But obviously, the goal is unity and to be God-honoring in this process. And there is a way to do that, right?
Absolutely. I mean, seeking the Lord, trying to get to common finances or being at peace with what the solution is, and ultimately that it's all honoring the Lord. We're always heading in the best direction when we're doing that.
The book can help. It's called Wise Women Managing Money. Valerie Hogan, thanks for stopping by today. We appreciate it.
Thanks, Rob. Great to be with you.
Your calls are next. 800-525-7000. We'll be right back.
The opinions offered during this program represent the personal or professional opinions of the participants, given for informational purposes only. Any information provided is not intended to replace advice from a financial, medical, legal, or other professional who understands your specific situation.
Well, thank you for joining us today for Faith and Finance Live. I'm Rob West, your host. Out of my studio today, I'm coming to you from Purcell Farms. It's in beautiful Sylacauga, Alabama, and this is a wonderful place. I'm here for the American Family Association's donor retreat. I'll be speaking in the morning, but delighted to be able to broadcast while I'm here, and look forward to taking your questions today. We've got lines open. Our team is ready to receive your call at 800-525-7000. That's 800-525-7000. You know, we started today by talking about a subject that I think is really important. I was delighted to be joined by my friend Valerie Hogan as we talk about estate planning for blended families. And, you know, if this is something you're struggling with, maybe you're in a blended family and wondering how to make wise financial decisions that are God-honoring, that bring you together in unity, and yet recognize you may have children from prior to the marriage, and that presents a host of questions and challenges with regard to estate planning. Well, Family Life Blended, a ministry of family life, is a wonderful resource. You'll find them at familylife.com. Just click on Family Life Blended. And one tool in particular that the team at Family Life Blended have come up with is something called a togetherness agreement. It's really a God-honoring document that allows you to write the rules, if you will, for marriage with love and respect for both parties, but recognizing that you're coming from perhaps prior marriages in this case. And how do you deal with all of the issues surrounding that? Familylife.com/blended is the place to go, and you can check it out while you're there. By the way, the book that has been written by Ron Deal is called The Smart Step Family, and you might want to check that out as well. All right, we're going to open up the phones for your questions on anything financial today. The number to call, 800-525-7000. You can call right now. Let's dive in at Lehigh Acres, Florida. Aura, how can I help you?
Thanks for taking my call, and thanks for educating us on financial matters. Okay, my question is, can I claim my charitable gifts plus my tithe when filing my taxes?
Perhaps.
Can I claim
them? I'm delighted to hear that you're a generous giver, giving faithfully to your church and even beyond that. It's going to come down to whether or not you take something called the standard deduction. Now, because the standard deduction was raised while President Trump was in office as a part of the Tax Cuts and Jobs Act of 2017, 90% of taxpayers no longer itemize and therefore cannot claim individual charitable contributions because they take the standard deduction. So are you married filing jointly, or do you file as a single filer?
No, jointly.
Okay.
Married jointly.
So your total deductions, and this could include charitable contributions and mortgage interest and a number of other things, if your total deductions exceed $27,700 for the tax year 2023, which is what you're probably about to file if you haven't already,
then you would itemize, and therefore you would list out those charitable deductions separately as a part of your itemized deductions. But if your total deductions are less than $27,700, you would take the standard deduction, and therefore you wouldn't claim those charitable deductions individually. Does that make sense?
Okay. Yes.
Okay.
Have to look my $27,000 if I do have that and more.
Yes.
Okay.
That would be the way to go. Thank you so much for calling, though, Aura, and call anytime. Colleen, I understand you have a similar question there in Illinois. Go right ahead.
Yes. Hi, Rob. Before I retired, I definitely benefited from itemizing my deductions, but now my income is so low that I can obtain a full refund with the standard deduction, but I anticipate beginning to take drawdowns from my retirement this year, and so my tax liability will be higher. So I was wondering if it would still be beneficial to itemize for 2023, because I will have a significant charitable carryover.
Yeah. It's just going to come down to whether or not you can get above that threshold. Are you a single filer or married filing jointly?
Single.
Okay. Yeah. So your number is going to be, at least for 2023, that number is going to be $13,850. So it would only benefit you if you get up above that. For 2024, it's $14,600. So if you have deductions totaling more than the standard deduction, then that's where you would claim that. And that's going to be you know, any number of things, including, you know, student loan interest or charitable contributions or mortgage interest, things like that, that can go against your income. But if you don't, the total of all of those does not get above that threshold, then you would take the standard deduction.
Well, I can get a full refund with the standard deduction. I don't need to itemize, but I was anticipating a carryover for the current year that might help with my tax liability for 2024 once I start drawing down taxable distributions from retirement. So that was basically the focus of my question. Whether it behooves me to itemize, I'm definitely over the standard deduction, but I don't need to get a full refund for 2023.
Right. So you can carry over your contributions that are not able to be deducted in the current tax year because they exceed your adjusted gross income. And so then you can deduct the excess in each of the next 5 years until it's all used up, but not beyond that point. So that may be, in fact, an opportunity for you.
Oh, great. Yeah. I appreciate that.
You are welcome. I would check with your CPA. Do you normally file your own taxes or do you use a tax preparer?
I file my own.
You do. Okay. Yeah. So that's certainly something to look at. Again, if you have, you know, significant charitable contributions and because of your work situation, you didn't get up above that threshold where you had more in charitable deductions than your adjusted gross income, that's where this benefit comes in. So something for you certainly to consider for future years. And, you know, we certainly want to pay our taxes with integrity. The Bible is very clear on that, but we don't want to pay any more than we're expected to. Colleen, thanks for your call today. We appreciate it. Well, folks, we're just getting started here today. We've got lines open. We'll be taking calls throughout the broadcast today. If you have questions, I'd love to hear them. 800-525-7000. That's 800-525-7000. You know, in the Sermon on the Mount, I love what Jesus says when he says, no one can serve two masters, for either you'll hate the one and love the other, you'll be devoted to the one and despise the other. You cannot serve God and mammon. He could have put anything else next to God as a potential rival. He chose money, and I think that's because it's one of the primary competitors to lordship. So let's make God our ultimate treasure and money a tool. We'll help you do that when we come back right after this. Stay with us. Great to have you with us today on Faith and Finance Live. I'm Rob West, coming to you today from the beautiful Purcell Farms in Sylacauga, Alabama, on location for a speaking engagement tomorrow, but taking the opportunity to broadcast from here. We're, of course, taking your calls and questions today. The lines are nearly full, one line open at 800-525-7000. You can call right now. Let's head right back to the phones to South Carolina. Hi, Bobby. Go right ahead.
Mr. West, it is finally a pleasure to speak to you, sir.
And you as well, sir.
Before I get into my question, just a bit of a testimony, if you want to call it that.
Okay.
I blame you for my interest in stewardship education. I've listened to you for a long time, and it's gotten me wanting to educate others on the issues of stewardship. And like I said, I blame you entirely.
I'm honored to take that on for you, sir. I'm delighted to hear that you've taken some interest in this topic. It's a very important one. I obviously share your passion there, so I'm delighted to hear that. Hey, how can I serve you today?
All right, sir. So my wife just recently got laid off from her job. She wasn't there very long, maybe a couple of years. They had given her a 401k that she had been contributing to, but it only built up to maybe $4,000 or $5,000. So we're wondering what we should do with that. For a little bit of background, we don't really have much of an emergency fund, and we don't really have anything else for retirement.
Okay. Well, I think that's your answer is, you know, so often folks with especially if you have a smaller 401k and you separate from your employer, a lot of folks will say, well, it's not a whole lot of money, relatively speaking. And so we're just going to take the withdrawal, close the account, not set anything aside for taxes. And then not only do they spend it on something that they've forgotten about a year later, but they haven't accounted for the fact that it's going to add $4,000 or $5,000 to your taxable income for the year. So in lieu of that, I would recommend you roll it out to an IRA and, you know, perhaps you just put it in one of the faith-based investing, stock mutual funds, or you could even choose a target date fund that would take a lot of the guesswork out, where you match the target date to her potential expected retirement, and then it'll kind of do all the rest for you, even getting more conservative as she gets closer to retirement. But the idea would be that, you know, if you guys have quite a bit of time between now and where the Lord may redirect you to something else in a retirement season of life, this could grow to something meaningful that could be used alongside other retirement assets. I think the key for you beyond that, though, is for you and your wife to do some planning to say, how can we begin to set aside something for the future? Not because we want to adopt the culture's view of retirement and come to this kind of cliff where we stop all productive work and we move into a period of a lifelong vacation. I don't think that's the biblical model. We were created to be productive in service to the Lord. Now, it may look different. There may be a season of sabbatical rest and seeking the Lord for what he has for the call in your life. But I like the idea of the elder at the city gate in the Bible being that person dispensing wisdom and experience, still being productive. I think there's a lot of health benefits to that we see clearly, in science. And so I think for you, the idea is to say, even though we may continue to work as long as we can, how can we dial back our spending so we've got something to be able to put away into retirement? If you have a company-sponsored plan at work, that would be a great option. If you don't, there's other vehicles. But I would be thinking about both things. One, rolling that over to an IRA and getting it invested and taking a long-term perspective. And two, thinking about how can we begin to amass other assets for that season of life. Does that make sense?
Yes, sir. I'd actually had been telling her that rolling it out to an IRA might be the best option, but we just wanted to get some expert advice.
Yeah, I like that a lot. And again, I think you could take a more passive approach to this. If you want to be invested, aligned with your values, and that's a conviction, you could go to our website, faithfi.com, click on the show, and you'll see a number of faith-based investing mutual fund families. If you'd prefer to take a more indexed approach, you could use one of the target date funds that I mentioned, or a robo-advisor like the Schwab Intelligent Portfolios or Betterment, where you just own the broad stock and bond market indexes and just capture the broad moves of the market over time. Any of those would work. I think the question is just, what is the right fit for you? Hopefully that's helpful, sir. Thank you for your kind remarks about the program, and I hope you keep up the good work on that stewardship education. God bless you. Let's go to Fishers, Indiana. Hi, Scott. Go ahead, sir.
Oh, hey, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. So I've got a question about retirement. So I'm 67 and a half, and so it makes me full retirement age. But I'm going to continue to work. And what I'd like to know is if I started taking my Social Security while I continue to work, planning on working till 70, and I put that money to paying off my mortgage, I think I can get my mortgage paid off in about 3 years. Puts me in a lot better shape for retirement, and wanted to know if that's a good or a bad idea.
Yeah. And what is your mortgage interest rate?
4.75%.
Okay. Yeah, I mean, I like that idea. And if you have a conviction to be out of debt as soon as possible, that's certainly one way to do it. And I like that you can do it in 3 years. I guess the flip side of that would be, you know, you're going to get a guaranteed return equal to that interest rate of a little less than 5%. You can also get a guaranteed increase on your Social Security if you wait till 70 of 8% a year. So you could do a little better. Now, that would likely mean that you got to hang on to this mortgage a little bit longer, and you need to live long enough to recoup everything you gave up during those 3 years. But if you do, and that's probably 11 years beyond age 70, then you could get a check that's about 25% higher for the rest of your life. Does that make sense?
It does. Yeah. I knew that's what I'd be giving up, and that's where the balance comes in. So,
yeah.
So
I don't think there's a right or wrong answer. Let's do this. I know you have a follow-up question. I've got to hit a break here. So if you don't mind, stay on the line. I'd love to get your follow-up question. This is a really great question, and one that I don't think has a right or wrong answer, but does need to be prayed through very well. We'll be right back. Hey, thanks for joining us today on Faith and Finance Live here on Moody Radio. I'm Rob West. Hey, if you'd like to support the ministry, we'd certainly be grateful. We can't bring you this program without listener support. And so if you want to become a monthly supporter, just head to faithfi.com and click give at the top of the page. That's faithfi.com. Before the break, we were talking to Scott in Fishers, Indiana. He has reached full retirement age. If he takes his Social Security now at full benefit, he could take that money while he's continuing to work, pay off his mortgage in 3 years. He likes that idea. We were just talking about the potential wisdom of delaying taking Social Security instead of getting the guaranteed return equal to the interest rate on the mortgage he'd be paying it off at about 4.75%. He could instead get that guaranteed increase of 8% a year by waiting to take Social Security. Now, that means he's got to live at least 11 or 12 years to get paid back for the money he gave up over the next 3 years in the form of a higher check from 70 to, let's say, ages 70 to 82. And he's going to have to live with that mortgage a little bit longer because he wouldn't have that extra income to pay it down so quickly. But Scott, you were going to ask a follow-up question, sir. Go ahead.
Yeah. So my wife is not full retirement eligible. So she's somewhat less than that age. And of course, that would mean she would take Social Security early with a benefit. And would it be a good idea to either take that instead, or would, in addition to, if I started my Social Security, and also to continue to pay off the mortgage with the extra money?
Yeah. Well, the only consideration there is she can get it. Now, you're talking about her taking a spousal benefit or based on her own work record?
Well, I'm not exactly sure which one it would be, because I guess that would be part of the question. So if I take mine and she starts to take hers, does that make her eligible for the spousal benefit?
It does. Yes, sir. So in order to get the spousal benefit, your spouse has to be receiving benefits. So if you were to start taking benefits, then she would be eligible for her spousal benefits, which is up to 50% of your benefit, so long as you're taking it. Now, if she takes it before full retirement age, then she's going to have her benefit reduced. And so it would be reduced by some amount, depending upon how far away she is from full retirement age. Now, one option is, though, if she will qualify on her own work record, she could start taking, again, as long as you start taking it first, her spousal benefit, and then let her benefit continue to grow, and at some point in the future, switch to to her own benefit, having let that continue to grow even beyond full retirement age up to age 70. And the Social Security will allow you to make that switch to a higher benefit at one time, and you can decide when.
Okay, because she would probably make more if she was taking the spousal benefit even now than she would if she started doing it off of her own work record.
Okay, so if she's never going to get above the spousal benefit, then that, again, may make sense for you guys, to delay, because you can get yours growing 8% a year beyond full retirement age up to age 70. She can get closer to or maybe at full retirement age, so she gets the full 50%, because she's going to get a haircut on that amount she would be receiving as a spousal benefit prior to full retirement age.
Okay, so would you recommend, based on that, if you were doing this,
I didn't need the money, because you guys are using this for surplus purposes, you're going to continue to work, you don't need the money. I kind of like you all getting this higher benefit locked in by waiting. You're going to pay some interest, but then you're going to get a check 25% higher. She's going to get a check probably at least 25% higher, and that's locked in for the rest of your lives, plus cost of living increases. And if you continued to work, you could even get it increased even more by replacing some of your high 35 years that are determining what your benefit is. So, for me, I like that option, just because that way, if you guys have long-term care needs down the road, something that's expensive beyond your current lifestyle, now you've got a bigger check every month to help you shoulder some of those additional potential burdens down the road.
Okay. All right. Yeah. That makes sense to me. Thanks.
All right. Thanks, Scott. We appreciate your call too. Indianapolis. Hi, Michael. Go ahead.
Hi, Rob. Thanks for taking my call. We have a 16-year-old who has started driving and will have his first job this summer. And my wife and I would like to start guiding him toward a path of being somewhat financially independent. And so our plan is he's going to set up his own savings and checking accounts for himself. But our specific question for you is, what do you think is the best modality to have available for him to make purchases when he's out on his own, whether it's filling up the gas tank or going out to dinner with some friends? Specifically when it comes to what's kind of the best thing, in your opinion, that would help him avoid like identity theft and all the problems associated with that.
Sure. Well, I think anything that involves, electronic communication and online access, even if he doesn't use the online access, any of these accounts can be compromised. The key is you just need to teach him best practices with regard to safeguarding his identity. So he doesn't need to be carrying around a Social Security card, and he doesn't need to be logging in to check his, checking account online at, a coffee shop over public Wi-Fi. He doesn't ever need to click a link in an email, or if somebody calls his cell phone and pretends like they're from his bank and says, we need you to verify your identity, he needs to know not to give that information out. As long as he's doing that, then I think at that point, it's a matter of just figuring out what are the best tools to use in the toolbox for you all to continue to walk alongside him. Capital One has a couple of great options, specifically typically for students. Their Capital One student, what's called money account, is basically a debit card, but it has parental controls where you can see it and get access to it through your own login. You could even lock it down. You can be alerted to certain things. He would have that debit card to use, you know, as he's out and about. And then you could connect that to the FaithFi app and teach him how to set up a budget, actually get the envelope system going. So every time he deposits a paycheck, he can allocate it to one of his digital envelopes in the FaithFi app. And then he can see, you know, what's left in each envelope. If he's saving for, you know, a future expense, or he has a certain amount in his eating out category, you know, or he's saving up some money or redirecting it to an IRA if he gets beyond, you know, the emergency savings that you feel like he needs. So I think a combination of education on identity theft best practices for safeguarding, combined with a great debit card that has parental controls like the Capital One money account, combined with something like the FaithFi app to teach budgeting. Does that make sense?
It does. Would you recommend the debit card linked to a checking account over like some of the reloadable cards that aren't necessarily tied to a checking account?
I like those just because they often have some different features, that can be really helpful, and you really don't have to worry about fraudulent transactions because we're not talking about a whole lot of money in that case. So I think they're just a little easier to use, and the technology tends to be a little better. Hey, stay on the line. We'll give you a 6-month subscription to the FaithFi app that you can pass along to your son, and hopefully that'll help get him pointed in the right direction. Michael, thanks for your call today. We appreciate it. May the Lord bless you. You sound like a great dad. We're going to take a quick break, back with more of your questions right around the corner. Stick around. Great to have you with us today on Faith and Finance Live here at Moody Radio. I'm Rob West, coming to you on location at Purcell Farms. I'm here for a speaking event with the American Family Association tomorrow, and delighted to be able to broadcast from here this week. We're taking your calls and questions today on anything financial, helping you apply the wisdom from God's Word to your financial decisions and choices. Let's go right back to the phones to St. Louis, Missouri. Hi, Brian. Thanks for your patience. Go ahead.
Yeah, I got a question. I did roll over from a previous employer. It's all in stock and bonds. It was a 401k retirement, and I put it in my retirement account I have now. Say in the future I wanted to take a withdrawal out, should I have the federal tax taken out with the withdrawal or wait until I get my taxes done for 2024? My opinion is I should have the taxes taken out with the withdrawal.
Yeah, I like that. I mean, basically, Uncle Sam wants your taxes paid as you earn or receive your income during the year. And, with a withdrawal, that would be the same thing there. And so I would say, you know, typically, if you owe less than $1,000 in tax, or if you've, it's a fairly small amount, you could probably get away with just waiting. But I think it's always better just to go ahead and have it withheld. That way you don't have to worry about that money being available, and you'd never have to think about there being any interest or penalties on sending that when you file later in the year or the following year.
That makes sense. Okay, thank you.
All right. Thanks for your call today. We appreciate it. 800-525-7000 is the number to call. We're taking your calls and questions today to Cleveland, Ohio. Hi, Kenya. Go ahead.
Hi. My name is Kenya, and I thank you for answering our questions. I have this great desire to buy a home, and I have $65,000 in my retirement, which I don't think is a lot, but I'm 46, and I want to know if I should take half of that. We'll take it all out and then put half of it on a home and then work the, continue to work to build the rest, to start all over with a new retirement. You think it's a good idea to take my retirement out, put half of it down on a house and, continue to live and recoup it all again?
Sure. Are you renting right now, Kenya?
Yes, I'm renting right now.
Okay. You know, I could certainly appreciate that you want to own a home. This is just not the way I would like to see you do it. And here's why. This is going to be expensive money in the sense that whatever you take out of that $65,000, not only is that going to be added to your taxable income for the year, so let's say you end up paying 22% in taxes, now you're going to have a 10% penalty on top of that because you're under 59 and a half. And so that's, you know, 30 plus percent right off the top that you're going to be paying to the IRS, not to mention the opportunity cost, which is basically that, you know, right now you've got the ability for that $65,000, if it's invested, to continue to grow for the next 20 plus years, even beyond that, and compound so that you've got something meaningful alongside Social Security to live on. As soon as you take that out, that's money that now is not only does it have to be replenished with other contributions, it's got less time to grow, and you're just going to end up with less in the end because, you know, you'd started with a lower amount by way of pulling it out. So what's the alternative? Well, the alternative, and I realize it may not be something you're excited about, and believe me, I get that. But just from a financial standpoint, the alternative is to continue to delay that home purchase, dial back your lifestyle spending, free up margin or surplus at the end of the month so that you can systematically save and try to build up enough for a down payment, even though it may take quite a bit longer. Now, one of the upsides to that is we would expect that in the next couple of years, interest rates on home mortgages would be lower than they are today. Hopefully, maybe a couple of percentage points lower, which is a big deal. That's going to save you a lot of money. So if you, right now, try to spend less, save more, wait, get a mortgage down the road, you know, when you can save quite a bit on your mortgage interest and let that full amount in that retirement account, $65,000, continue to grow for the next 20 years, I think you'll be glad you made that decision when you get to that point in your life. Does that make sense, though?
Yeah, it's hard to hear, but it does make sense.
Okay.
I appreciate you.
You're welcome. I wish I had better news for you. I understand how bad you want that house, but I think you'll be glad you're always making a better financial decision when you have the long-term perspective. The longer your perspective, the better the decision you make today. That's just a wise money management principle. And so I realize today you want that house, but if you make the decision with the long perspective, you're going to say, you know what, it does make sense for me to delay this purchase so I can ultimately have more down the road. All right, let's go to Minnesota. Hi, Amy, go right ahead.
Hi, thanks for taking my call. My husband and I recently sold our home, and we have a substantial capital gains on it. But my question is about tithing. We'd like to tithe off of that gain, and we are looking for some creative ideas because the amount is significant.
Yeah. We didn't know, so let me just ask a couple of questions. Was this your primary residence?
It was, yes.
Okay. And so was your gain beyond the $500,000 exclusion you had?
Yes, it was.
Okay. And so what do you have roughly in terms of the profit, the capital gain beyond the $500,000?
Over $1 million.
Okay. Or another $1 million beyond that.
Yeah. Yeah.
Okay. Got it. Yeah. And so, and don't feel like you have to answer this, but is your income such that you're going to be up in the 20% bracket? You had more than $550,000 in AGI?
No.
Okay. So you had between 90 and $500,000, basically.
Correct.
Okay. So you'd have 15% capital gains. So you're talking about $150,000 potentially. Is that what you're looking at?
Yeah, we were thinking that'd probably be what we would tithe. Yeah.
Okay. Got it. Yeah. So it's not one-to-one in the sense that you're going to pay that capital gain either way, but you could make a substantial contribution and, you know, offset some of your other taxable income, which is just going to help in the end. So what I would look at in terms of a creative opportunity, I mean, one of the vehicles I would tend to recommend, but that's no longer available, is you could give away a portion of the home, prior to the sale. So let's say you gave 20% of the house to your donor advised fund, then that portion misses out on the capital gain. At this point, it's already been sold, so we can't do that. But what you could do is take the amount that you want to give in cash, give it to a donor advised fund. What's the benefit of that? Well, the benefit is you get that full tax deduction, or at least the charitable contribution, in one tax year, and then you don't have to give it away all in this year if you don't want to. Now, you may know exactly where you want 100% of that money to go right away, and if you did, you could just write the check directly to the ministry or charity. But if you don't, but you want to go ahead and get it all in this year, then you give it to a donor advised fund, and then you get the full charitable contribution, and then you could give it away this year, next year, over several years. So that's one way to go if you're not familiar with that tool.
No, thank you. I appreciate that. Yeah.
Yeah.
I didn't know that. Okay.
What I would do is head to the National Christian Foundation, ncfgiving.com. It was founded by Ron Blue and Larry Burkett and a couple of others. They call it a giving fund, but it's just a donor advised fund. Very easy to set up. You can do it in just a few minutes over the internet, ncfgiving.com. And then again, you could make the contribution. And then at that point, it's like a charitable checking account. You've given the money away, so you get the contribution, and then you'd recommend the grants that they would make on your behalf, at your leisure.
Oh, very good. That's okay. That's exactly what I'm looking for. Thank you.
Awesome. You're welcome, Amy. Thanks for your call today. Quickly to Nebraska. We've just got a couple of minutes left. Scott, go ahead.
Yes. I've got a retirement account, me and my wife, and she's 58 and I'm 59. And it's mostly invested in the market, stocks and bonds. And I was wanting to take half of it out and put it into CDs. You think that'd be a good idea?
So it's a retirement account, and you'd actually take it out of the stocks, but leave it in the retirement account and then buy brokered CDs, perhaps?
Yes. Right, or roll it over into CD, yes.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And what are you looking to do, just to get more conservative?
Well, our retirement account was a certain number. It was around $1 million 3 years ago, and it's worth the same today. So I want to gain something, you know?
Sure. Sure. You know, I guess the only thing I would say, Scott, is that, I mean, because we're living longer, I mean, you need to plan for this money to last for the next 30 plus years, right? And so obviously none of us know the day or the hour the Lord is going to call us home. But because we have more longevity with advances in modern medicine, I think, you know, you taking a 3-decade time horizon on this money allows you to, you know, take a little bit more risk. And so, you know, if at 60 we were to say, okay, you know, let's put 50% in stocks and 50% in fixed income, which is probably about the right number at your age, then what I would do is say, okay, among the stock portion, how do we want to be properly diversified? And you can use mutual funds and ETFs and individual stocks, either yourself or with an advisor. But for that other 50%, I'd probably be thinking about a 5% allocation to gold. And then with the rest of it, I think a mix between perhaps the CDs, some high-quality, shorter-term treasuries, and then corporate high-quality corporate bonds would make for a really nice portfolio, give you some nice growth, especially as the interest rates come down with some healthy yields, but give you half the portfolio that still has the ability to grow and appreciate with the increase of those stocks. Something to think about. I don't hate the idea, but perhaps that gives you some more options. Thanks for your call. Faith and Finance Live is a partnership between Moody Radio and Faith Fi. We'll see you tomorrow. God bless you.